Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries over the internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Economics 101 when we come back. Now, let me ask you this. What do you think's wrong with the Ten Commandments? Because it's pretty obvious that something is wrong with the Ten Commandments because they've been banned from our public schools. They've been banned from our public institutions and our national consciousness. Now, instead of these 10 simple, time-tested laws, we see the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto in their place, and they're teaching these 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto in our public schools, our public institutions. We've made them a part of our national psyche. You know, this is a pretty radical change in our political and moral outlook over the past 50 years. Are you aware, for instance, that your daughter couldn't receive an aspirin in your public school without your consent, but your daughter could have an abortion arranged through that same public school nurse without even your knowledge, much less your consent? That's why I contend that the solution to this kind of moral perversion and national insanity is to go back to what worked. Let's go back to the Ten Commandments and the Mosaic Law. You know, our founding fathers practiced and advocated the Ten Commandments. They even put 22 principles of that law into our federal constitution. And there's still at least one school left in America that's teaching this entire Mosaic Law, the Ten Commandments, and all 759 statutes, judgments, commandments, and penalties, as well as the 33 benefits for their observance. Now, every law has a penalty. You don't have to know what the penalty to a law is in order to suffer from its effects. So whether we call this the Mosaic Law, the law of God, the common law, or natural law, or karma, or something else, it's automatic. And it works just like AIDS, herpes, and VD, which happens to be the natural penalty for adultery. Now, if you'd like more information, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free of charge. And you can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. 4967. Now, if you're online, go to the website georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the archives page and download that free general law CD package right there off your computer. All right, we have been talking about economics. Economics 101. It comes from a book called Economics in One Lesson. It was written by Henry Hazlitt, and it explains in dramatic detail the free market or the free enterprise system. Now, we here in America like to talk a lot about the free market and private enterprise and capitalism, but what we're really practicing in this country is socialism and planned market economy, or economics or economies in the same way that the Russians did. We have the same kind of communist economic philosophies here in America that they use in Russia, China, and every place else in the world. It is true that we used to practice free market economics in the United States, but over a long period of time, it has now morphed into socialist economic dogma. And we've been talking about that. And the other side of the coin over here is in the book called Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt. You can get a copy at Barnes & Noble, about 15 bucks, something on that order. Well worth it. It's 200 pages, easy to read. Written for dummies like me and probably dummies like you, truck drivers and housewives. Those of us that don't have the credentials, you know, to run around and use big words with 4 or 5 syllables. Now, in this concluding segment, I wanted to hit the economic theory from the scripture. There are 15 economic laws that are related to economics, and they're all revealed in scripture. The creator of the universe is not ignorant about buying, selling, and trading. The creator is not ignorant about economics 101, and he wrote up several laws. Now, in the last segment, in the last program, I pointed out to you that there were some economic laws, and that one of the presidential advisors, his name was Herbert Stein, wrote a little ditty called Stein's Law, and he said, if something cannot go on forever, it will stop. Well, this something that can't go on forever is called an unsustainable trend. And we're being told more and more often now by our political leaders and economic leaders that these trends, these borrowings and these bailouts, are an unsustainable trend that cannot go on forever. Well, just common sense would tell you that, but of course common sense has been divorced from economics now in this country for about 75 years, or since the New Deal took office in the 1930s. Americans never believed that they could spend themselves into debt and get rich until this last era from the 1930s came upon us. Nobody believed for a moment you could get something for nothing like Social Security and unemployment insurance. We all knew that there was a cost involved. But the only thing that you and I know is what we learned in school. And we went to public school, and the people that control the curriculum in the public school system taught us what they wanted us to know. So they taught us socialist fascist economics. They taught us John Maynard Keynes. They did not teach us Henry Hazlitt. They didn't teach us the Austrian School of Economics. They didn't teach us about Adam Smith. So that's a void. Now, you've probably heard of the Austrian School of Economics, and you've probably heard of Adam Smith, but you don't know anything about them. You've never looked at their economic philosophies. Well, these economic philosophies of the free market and of supply and demand come from the Bible, and there are 15 of these economic laws. So let me just run through them quickly for you. Credit is number one in alphabetical order, credit. Gleaning, that is, it deals with minimum wage. What's the lowest possible wage you could get in biblical terms? And it's gleaning a field, going out and working for. They used to call it workfare when Ronald Reagan was governor of California. He wanted to call that workfare. Then there are two groups of people that work. There are Hebrew servants and hired servants. A Hebrew servant is distinguished because he cannot be pressed into service for longer than 7 years. And then there are hired servants. We call those people employees today. And those hired servants who could be pressed into employment for longer than 7 years, but they have to be paid at the end of every day, employees. Kind of a strange thing. You have to pay this guy at the end of every day. Then there's an inheritance law that deals with property and property rights. Then we have a land Sabbath and a jubilee. Land Sabbath and a jubilee. The land shall not be sold forever, and so every 50 years it has to go back to its original owner. And land Sabbaths deal with geometric progression and debt release. And then there's just weights and balances. That's gold and silver coin. Our founding fathers put that one right into our Constitution at Article 1, Section 10. No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt. That comes from Leviticus 19, 35, and 36. God told you not to use unjust weights and balances. And then if you violate these laws, there's a punishment that comes from it. The punishment is 2, 4, 5, or 7 times the amount of the theft. And we have a theft law that says thou shalt not steal. And when you deal in unjust weights and balances, that's mortgages, usury, interest, stocks, bonds, and things like that, you're committing a theft, and those thefts have penalties, and the penalties are automatic. You don't need a policeman to come out and give you a ticket, arrest you, and haul you off to jail like Bernie Madoff. God has a built-in system of crime and punishment, and you get what goes around comes around. And then there are tithes, 3 tithes plus holy day offerings, and they're expounded in Malachi 3, verse 8. God has an economic system that requires that you pay them 10% of the cut. It's like paying your income tax. And if you don't pay them, then you can't get the economic blessings that are entitled to that you're entitled to. Usury, there is none allowed. You cannot pay interest and you can't charge interest on any kind of monetary transaction, period. Not even 0.01% per century would be acceptable. None, zero, zilch. Now, most of us are paying, 15-20% interest on our credit cards. 28%. We've got mortgages that we're paying on. We've got car loans we're paying on, consumer loans that we're paying on. Every one of those loans is a criminal enterprise. And then there's wages. There's a wage standard set in the scriptures. And then there's a work standard. In fact, Jesus said, I work and my Father works. And there's a work week for these wages. And the work week is 72 hours. 6 days a week from 6 in the morning till 6 at night. A 12-hour work day is the correct work day, not 8, not 6. Now, I know you're sitting there saying, well, that's a bit. That God's a real terrorist. He expects us to go out and glean fields instead of collecting welfare and food stamps. He expects us to work 72 hours a week and 6 days a week instead of 40 hours a week and 5 days. And he expects that you pay your wages every day. Can't practice usury and interest. You have to tithe. You can't steal. You can't have insurance. Insurance is called strict liability, and insurance is an economic law. You pay a penalty when you pay insurance premiums, and you pay a penalty when you pay usury and interest. All right, so those are the 15 economic laws. Work, wages, usury, tithes, theft, strict liability, punishment, land Sabbaths, just weights, jubilees, inheritance, hired servants, Hebrew servants, gleaning, and credit. Those are the 15. Let's take a look at some of these, and then let me show you how they work. Taking a look here at the wages statute, wages. Flipping the page here, Leviticus 19:13, you shall not defraud your neighbor, neither rob him. The wages of him that is hired shall not abide with you all night until the morning. I know that's kind of a wild story, isn't it? I mean, we get paid every Friday, or we get paid every 2 weeks, or in the case of when I was a kid, we got paid once a month on the 15th of the month when the creamery paid the dairyman paid all their hired help. Not so. God says, you got to pay this guy at the end of every day. There's no float allowed. You can't take this guy and use his money in your business for a week, 2 weeks, or a month. Or in the case of companies that pay vacation pay, all of that accrued vacation pay or sick time pay sits in the company bank account for them to use interest-free. And the creator of the universe says, not by the hair on your chinny-chin-chin. And he goes on, he says, you shall not oppress a hired servant that is poor and needy, whether he be of your brethren or of your strangers. And so here's a law that tells you employers out there, do not oppress a hired servant. At his day you shall give him his hire. neither shall the sun go down upon it, because he's pouring, he sets his heart upon it, lest he cries out unto the eternal, and it be a sin unto you. Woe unto him that builds his house by unrighteousness, and his chambers by wrong, that uses his neighbor's service without wages, and giveth him not for his work. The other day I was watching TV, and some companies here in Springfield have gone broke. You know, it's tough times. And they didn't pay the wages of their hired men. Well, boys and girls, the number one guy that gets paid under the law of God is the hired servant. It may be true that you owe your suppliers. And it may be true that you owe the landlord the rent on the factory building. But you don't pay the rent before you pay the hired servant. So now that's just one law. Let's just flip that one over here on the side, and let me pull out another one here called tithing. Now here in America, we pay income tax. And we would rather pay an income tax of 42% than we would to pay our God 10%. Now don't ask me why that's true. I'm just reporting to you that that's the way the game is played. But when we talk about tithing, and there's a statute over here in Malachi 3, verse 8, and it says, "Will a man rob God? Yet you have robbed me." But you people say, "Wherein have we robbed you?" And the answer is in tithes and offerings. Tithes, plural. And that's because there are three tithes. First tithe, second tithe, and third tithe. And offerings. It's against the law to come before the eternal empty. And there are seven annual holy days. Now here's a kicker. When people go to church, every week they put an offering in the offering plate every week. The law does not require an offering every week. The law requires an offering on every holy day. Every holy day, seven of them. The seven annual holy days, nobody practices, keeps, or pays their offerings, and they make their offerings on the Sabbath day once a week, which they are not commanded to do. Isn't that special? And so he says, now there are tithes and offerings. He says, you are cursed with a curse because you have robbed me, even this whole nation. America is now living under a curse. This economic collapse, boys and girls, is not a blessing. Not a blessing. This is a curse. And we haven't gotten to the worst part of it yet. We're getting leaned on. And the hope is that you'll wake up to reality and you will stop what you have been doing that caused this curse to come upon you. And that you'll repent and turn around and do something different. That is not going to happen. It's not very likely. There might be a few, but it's not very likely. It hasn't happened in the past, it ain't happening today, and it ain't likely to happen in the future. But just for your information, so that you'd know, this is Malachi 3, verse 8. I didn't write this. I didn't sneak into your house last night and sneak this into your Bible. So Malachi 3, verse 8 through 12. Read them and weep, as they say down at the Blue Room. He said, you have robbed me in tithes and offerings. You're cursed with a curse because you've robbed me, even this whole nation. The whole nation. He's not after you Mormons. He's not after you Baptists or Catholics. He said, the whole damn nation's robbed me. Now bring you all of the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be meat in my house. And prove me now herewith, says the Eternal of Hosts, if I will not open you the windows of heaven, and pour you out a blessing, that there shall not be room enough to receive it. And I will rebuke the devourer for your sakes, and he shall not destroy the fruits of your ground, neither shall your vine cast her fruit before the time in the field, says the Eternal of Hosts, and all nations shall call you blessed, for you shall be a delightsome land, says the Lord of Hosts. So now, tithing and holy day offerings are an important aspect to wealth and prosperity. If you'll practice these 15 economic laws, you'll make a lot of money. You'll be very wealthy and prosperous. If you practice 13 out of 15, you'll make a lot of money, and you'll be very wealthy and prosperous. If you practice 10 of these, you'll make a little money. If you practice 5 of them, better than nothing. I would almost venture a guess to say that here in the United States of America, we violate all 15. Well, just take a look. Credit. We pay interest on our credit cards. We are borrowing money on mortgages and paying usury and interest. We will not glean. We're working on welfare. We want welfare. We want something for nothing. We will not go out and glean and work. And then when it comes to hired servants over here, we don't pay our hired servants every day. We pay them once a week or once every 2 weeks. And when it comes to the Jubilee and Land Sabbaths, we don't practice Land Sabbaths and Jubilees. We practice strict liability with insurance, which is prohibited. We're a nation of thieves. We don't pay God his tithes, first, second, third, or his offerings. We all practice usury and interest. We don't pay our hired help every day, and we don't want to work 72 hours a week. We're going to work 40. In fact, most of us want to work 30 or 35 or something less than that. So as we go through these 15 economic laws, we're not in compliance with a single one of them. Now, there may be some individuals out there that are. I wouldn't judge everybody, but he said, the nation, the whole nation has robbed me. All right, so will a man rob God? The answer is, you bet. Move over, God. I'm going to rob you. Now let's take a look at just weights and balances. just weights and balances. You shall do no unrighteousness in judgment, in meat yard, in weight, or in measure. Just balances, just weights, a just ephah, and a just hin shall you have. I am the Eternal your God. Deuteronomy 25:13-16. You shall not have in your bag diverse weights, a great and a small. You shall not have in your house diverse measures, a great and a small. But you shall have a perfect and a just weight, a perfect and a just measure shall you have. Why? Well, that your days may be lengthened in the land which the Eternal gives you. For all that do such things, and all that do unrighteously, are an abomination unto the Eternal. Now, you know the average Joe Sixpack Christian over here, he says, I pay my mortgage faithfully, and I pay my credit cards. I pay all of my debts. Now, that's your problem. You've got stocks and bonds. Those are unjust weights and balances. You use paper money, like Federal Reserve note dollars. You don't use gold and silver, just weights and balances. You got a mortgage on your house that you're servicing with interest. You got credit cards, and you're paying interest on them. Hell, even your church, in all probability, has borrowed money to build their church or sanctuary or something, and you've signed up to underwrite the church debt in the building program pledge, remember? Right. Well, those are crimes. Those are crimes. Now, of course, most people don't see that as being a crime. They believe what their church tells them. They believe what they've learned all their life. I'm just a reporter. I just wanted to let you know that the reason that this economic collapse is coming upon the entire world is because the entire world is entering into a period of time described in Bible prophecy as being the Great Tribulation. This is the grand smash climax. This is the payoff. Now, we've been giving God the finger for the last probably 4,000 years, but at least the last 100 here in the United States. Up until about 1900, you know, we were, you know, fair to middling good people. We practiced a lot of the law, not all of it, but we did, in fact, practice a lot of it. And then starting about 1900, we got fatter and more and more prosperous, and as time progressed along, you know, we just got to be downright insolent. And by the time the Great Depression came upon us in the 1930s, which was kind of our just desserts after having created the Federal Reserve, and going into paper money, and then we went into World War I, and then we got the inflation that came from it in the Roaring Twenties. Then the deflation was the deflation that comes from those excesses. And we decided to go off into socialism. Well, okay. Now that we got through with the socialism of the 1930s, we needed another war to bail us out. And then in 1971, we decided we weren't going to pay our debts in gold as a nation. We're going to go on to fiat currency, and we did. Now, it's gone on for a long time, and nations and empires and civilizations can do that more effectively than individuals or families, but it all comes to an end. Every civilization, empire, every great nation that's ever gone into fiat currency has always gone bankrupt upside down in a national captivity. And America isn't going to be any different, in my view. Now, maybe you've got a new trick up your sleeve here, partner, but I think that we're going to pay just like the Romans and everybody else. Now, there's a subject in here called credit. Credit. Now, it is not against the law to borrow. It's against the law to pay interest on the borrowed money. And it's against the law to take collateral. You cannot collateralize a debt. Now, I know all you people out there say, oh, my God, you can't do that. Well, I don't know why not. The creator of the universe said you could. In fact, he created a couple of laws there, and he said this is the way that you want to operate your economy. Now, when we follow these biblical principles, not even all of them, just some of them, like in 1787, we followed some of these biblical principles, and America became the wealthiest, most powerful nation in the world. You people in Detroit built a marvelous city there. And then in the 1930s, when you started to deviate from more and more of these economic principles, and you went further and further, you drifted further and further away from free market economics and more into socialistic practices, your city now is unsustainable. And it's disintegrating right in front of your eyeballs. And you're sitting there kind of lamenting it and saying, oh, I just don't know what happened here. Oh, I just don't know what we're going to do. So, okay, don't let me get in the way of your happiness and success. But, you know, if you want to be successful at this program, you're going to have to practice the laws that go along with it. Kind of reminds me of the Big Bang Theory. The Big Bang, that's where all the mass and matter of the universe has always existed. Yeah, it's the exact opposite from the laws of thermodynamics to say there's been no past eternity of matter. So in physics, we know there's been no past eternity of matter. And so the evolutionists, they come down and they say, well, all the mass and matter that you're looking at in the universe was all compacted down into a little bit of mass, very, very dense, and it was about the size of the dot at the end of this sentence. Well, okay. I'm not arguing about the size of it. I said it never existed. It came into existence. And so they said, oh, no. It never came into existence. It's always been there. And then we got the oscillating universe theory. That's where the little dot blows up, and then it compresses back down to a little dot and blows up, and then it compresses back to a little dot and so on. Now, the laws of physics are pretty plain. You know, you can take this to the bank. There's been no past eternity of matter. All mass and matter came into existence at some point in time. So where did it come from? And the evolutionist says it's always existed, and the laws of physics say no, it hasn't. Well, same thing's true here with economics. And there are certain fundamentals in economics, and this is the way it works, and you know, whether you like it or not, And if you violate these laws, well, then there's a penalty that has to be paid. And that's just where reality is located. Now, here's a little law here under credit. The land shall not be sold forever, because the land is mine and you're strangers and sojourners with me. And if a man sells a dwelling house in a walled city, then he may redeem it within a whole year after it is sold. Within a full year may he redeem it. And if he be not redeemed, or if it be not redeemed within the space of a full year, then the house that's in the walled city shall be established forever to him that bought it throughout his generations, and it shall not go out in the Jubilee. That's called adverse possession. If you lend money to any of my people that is poor by you, you shall not be unto him as a usurer, and neither shall you lay upon him usury. If you at all take your neighbor's raiment to pledge, that's collateral, you shall deliver it unto him by the end of the sun goes down, for that's his covering only. It's his raiment for his skin, wherein shall he sleep. And it shall come to pass, when he cries unto me, that I'll hear, because I'm gracious. here's another one. No man shall take the neither or the upper millstone to pledge, for he takes a man's life to pledge. You know, we still practice that in this country. For instance, if you go through bankruptcy, you can't take the tools of a man's trade. So, you know, if you're a carpenter and the creditors say, well, we want to take everything this carpenter's got because he hasn't paid his debts, and that includes his saws and drills and planes. No. We let you keep the tools of your trade. Where'd that custom come from? Came right here from Deuteronomy 24, verse 6. Now, in Ezekiel 18, verses 8 through 18, there's a little story here I'll relate to you here that deals with usury. He that has not given forth upon usury, neither has taken any increase, that has withdrawn his hand from iniquity. See this usury. See these bankers out here charging you 28% on your credit card? Those people have their hands in iniquity, but has executed true judgment between man and man, has walked in my statutes and kept my judgments to deal truly. He is just. He shall surely live, says the Eternal. He shall surely live. Well, what's the opposite to that? If you want to practice usury and interest, shall you surely live, or should you surely die? Hey, I'm at the halfway point here, and I've got to give you a reminder that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about The Law School or The Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. I'll tell you the whole story right there. georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches 8 schools in all. They are family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. That's for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order that by calling the law school and asking for it. The number to call is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, we have a shortcut for you. You can go to our website, georgegordon.org, click onto the archives page. All of these radio programs are archived on the Internet on our website. They go back for about 10 years. We do one a day, 365 a year. So there's over 3,000 of these programs that are archived. And you can go to our archives page, and this free general law CD package is on that page somewhere, somehow. All of you smart people out there that know how to use computers can probably download that. That's what they tell me here. Now, I'm a computer illiterate, so I can't do it, but I'm trusting that you can. georgegordon.org, go to the archives page, download it free. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind now that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, they're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers or the sponsors or the management or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, remember our website is georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about economic law, Economics 101. And we have selected three sources of information here this week. Actually, four. We've selected the Bible, the Scripture. That's what we're working on today. The Privateer, the International Forecaster, and Henry Hazlitt's book on economics in one lesson. So I would suggest that you get a copy of Hazlitt's book. His name is spelled H-A-Z-L-I-T-T, Henry Hazlitt. Wrote the book in 1946, been out for a long time. This is the 50th anniversary issue. And it's copyrighted 1996, 1962, 1979, 1946. So it's been around for a long time. It's been updated a couple of three times. Henry Hazlitt, H-A-Z-L-I-T-T. All right, then The Privateer is from Australia. It comes from Queensland, Australia. Bill Buckler is the fellow that publishes it. He's at Post Office Box 2004 in Noosa Heads, Queensland, 4567, Australia. Or if you're modern and up to date, you can go on your computer to his webpage, which is the-privateer.com. If you want to write him an email, go to capt@the-privateer.com. And then we've got this newsletter from Bob Chapman. I gave you a review of that one. This one is the February 10th issue, February 10, 2010 issue of theinternationalforecaster.com. All one word, theinternationalforecaster.com. And that'll give you the sources of information that we are using to tell you this story. All right, so we're looking at credit. Quite a few statutes here on credit. Deals with usury, deals with collateral, deals with jubilees, and land sabbaths, one thing and another. Showed you about just weights and balances over here. Now, just weight and balances, gold and silver coin. You know, we Americans used to use that. You Englishmen, in fact, all of you Western Europeans used to have gold and silver. Some of you still have a little bit, but, you know, it's not much, and there's few and far between. All right, so then there's wages. I've covered about four or five of those. And put this little stack right here, and then we open up Hazlitt's book over here, and let's talk about one last item over here called The Function of Profit. Profit, to most men here in the socialist states of America, is a dirty four-letter word, profit. Profits are wicked and evil, and we ought to abolish them and do away with them. Profits are absolutely necessary, and the creator of the universe uses the word profit. He talks about a profitable servant. I think I mentioned this to you yesterday. If you've got a job and you work on that job and you do everything that's expected of you, you are an unprofitable servant. And that's because you did what was expected. A profitable servant goes above and beyond the call of duty. He isn't the guy that works from 8 to 4:30. He's the guy that gets there 15 minutes early and leaves 15 minutes late and does it every day. He's the guy that's there to work on Sundays after work and to volunteer for whatever jobs need to be done to make sure that this business, this enterprise succeeds. If the employees that work for the employers of America were as concerned about the viability and the success of the enterprise, there would be many fewer of those enterprises going bankrupt. Now, I mentioned the other day there isn't any employee in America that can double his output. Now, if you say, well, why not in my job, but can you add 10% to your output? Just 10%. Whatever it is that you're producing every day for your boss, could you, if you worked just a little harder, just moved a little faster, could you do 10% more of them, whatever it is? Could you file 10 more papers in a day? Could you review 10 more files in a day? And could you produce 10 more little widgets at your machine in a day, if you put your mind to it? Because if you could improve your output by 10%, it would add 10% more profit. It would cut the labor cost that you cost by 10%. And you can rest assured that when you do that, your boss is not going to miss it. Because I'm an old-timey boss. I'm an old-timey employer. And I can tell you from personal experience, there isn't a boss out there worth his salt that doesn't know what the hell every employee in that plant is producing. They watch it. They will ask the lead men or the foreman, what's that guy produce every day? How is he? Is he any good? Is he a profitable guy? And the lead man and the foreman and the shop steward and whoever you know, they're using to check up on you if they're not looking at you with a two-way mirror or something like that, or measuring your output based upon the paperwork that's turned in, and then analyzing the amount of money that we're paying and what we're receiving from you and whether or not you're making the company money or not. You can rest assured they know exactly what you're producing. And when push comes to shove, they will get rid of the unprofitable servants first. Well, unless, of course, you work for the union and you're on the seniority system, in which case then they have to keep the poorest non-producing workers on the force, and the best and the most productive workers have to be let go first. But isn't that backward? Huh? Come on. Isn't that backward? Doesn't that, does that make any sense? I mean, that's the way we do it, and I don't deny it. But is that logical? And as a result of that, can you begin to understand why it is business is failing and companies are outsourcing, like I explained to you the last time about the Stanley Company? God, people were just up in arms about the Stanley Company moving their operations overseas. I'm not up in arms. I understand exactly why the Stanley Company moved. I know exactly why companies are outsourcing and sending the work overseas. Government policy. Whether it's accidental or it's being done on purpose, it's government policy. Let's take a look at profits. The indignation shown by many people today at the mention of the very word profit indicates how little understanding there is of the vital function that profits play in our economy. To increase our understanding, we shall go over again some of the ground already covered in Chapter 15 on the price system, but we shall view the subject from a little different angle. Profits actually do not bulk large in our total economy. The net income of incorporated business in the 15 years from 1929 to 1943, to take some figures, averaged less than 5% of the total national income. Corporate profits after taxes in the 5 years from 1956 to 1960 averaged less than 6% of the national income. Corporate profits after taxes in the 5 years 1971 through 75 also averaged less than 6% of the national income, in spite of the fact that as a result of insufficient accounting adjustments for inflation, they were probably overstated. Yet profits are the form of income toward which there is most hostility, and it is significant that while there is a word profiteer to stigmatize those who make allegedly excessive profits, there is no such word as wagerer or loser, and yet the profits of the owner of a barbershop may average much less, not merely than the salary of a motion picture star or the hired head of a steel corporation, but less even than the average wage for skilled labor. Now, the subject is clouded by all sorts of factual misconceptions. The total profits of General Motors, the greatest industrial corporation in the world, are taken as if they were typical rather than exceptional. Few people are acquainted with the mortality rates for business concerns. They do not know, to quote from the TNEC studies, that should conditions of business averaging the experience of the last 50 years prevail, about 7 out of every 10 grocery stores opening today will survive into their second year. Only 4 of the 10 may expect to celebrate their 4th birthday. They do not know that in every year from 1930 to 1938, in the income tax statistics, the number of corporations that showed a loss exceeded the number that showed a profit. And how much do profits on the average amount to? And this question is commonly answered by citing the kind of figures that I presented at the beginning of this chapter. The corporate profit average is less than 6% of the national income, or by pointing out that the average profits after income taxes of all manufacturing corporations are less than 5 cents per dollar of sales. And for the 5 years 1971 through 1975, for example, the figure was only 4.6 cents. Now, these official figures, though they fall far below popular notions of the size of profits, apply only to corporate and corporation results. Calculated by conventional methods of accounting, no trustworthy estimate has been made that takes into account all kinds of activities, unincorporated as well as incorporated businesses, and a sufficient number of good and bad years. But some eminent economists believe that over a long period of years, after allowance is made for all losses, for a minimum riskless interest on invested capital, and for an imputed reasonable wage value of the services of people who run their own businesses, no net profit at all may be left over, and that there may even be a net loss. This is not at all because entrepreneurs are people who go into business for themselves, are intentional philanthropists, but because their optimism and their self-confidence too often lead them into ventures that do not or cannot succeed. So it is clear in any case that any individual placing venture capital risks or runs a risk not only of earning no return but of losing his whole principal. In the past, it has been the lure of high profits in special firms or industry that has led him to take that great risk. But if profits are limited to a maximum of, say, 10% or some similar figure, while the risk of losing one's entire capital still exists, what is likely to be the effect on the profit incentive and hence on employment and production? The World War II excess profits tax showed that such a limit, or what such a limit can do, even for a short period of time, in undermining efficiency. Yet governmental policy almost everywhere today tends to assume that production will go on automatically, no matter what is done to discourage it. One of the greatest dangers to world production today still comes from government price-fixing policies. Not only do these policies put one item after another out of production by leaving no incentive to make it, but their long-run effect is to prevent a balance of production in accordance with the actual demands of consumers. So when the economy is free, demand so acts that some branches of production make what some government officials regard as excessive, unreasonable, or even obscene profits. But that very fact not only causes every firm in that line to expand its production to the utmost and to reinvest its profits in more machinery and more employment, it also attracts new investors and producers from everywhere until production in that line is great enough to meet demand and the profits in it again fall to or below the general average level. Now, I'm an old-timey entrepreneur. I've done a number of businesses over the years. It takes about 36 months from the time you launch a business until you get it established to a point that it'll become profitable. 36 months. So if you're going to open a beauty parlor or a barber shop or a mechanics garage or something, you can plan on investing your capital and working long hours for very little. You'll probably make less than you did working for wages. But you have the expectation. You have the desire. You have the purpose in mind that you're going to make more than you made as a wage earner. You want to be your own boss. You want to have something of your own. And you want to expand that. Now, small business in America employs about 65% of the people in the country. Those are businesses that employ from 1 to 100 employees. 1 to 100. 65% of all of us work for companies that size. Now, 25% of us work for people like Ford and IBM and General Motors and Bill Gates, and 10% of us work for government. Now, when you break that down and break that out, everybody has a desire to go into business for himself. I say everybody, but most people do. I mean, there may be some people out there that say, no, I don't want to do that, but in my business experience, in my life's experience, that's what I find. Now, not very many people actually do it, but nearly everybody would like to. And I can remember many times people would say, boy, I wish I could do that. Boy, I wish I was like you, Mr. Gordon. I just go out there and open a business up and be my own boss. And I just come to work when I want to. And it's true. And I can get up when I want to. This morning I got up at 8 o'clock. 8 o'clock. But for the last few mornings I've been getting up about 10. It's been cold out. I get up about 10 in the morning. And people will say, oh, boy, I wish I could do that. Well, you could, I guess, if you were your own boss. But hey, listen, if I elect to stay in bed till 10, I'm not producing anything between 8 and 10. And I don't get paid for that 2 hours that I didn't work and produce anything. So you need to understand that when you're your own boss, you don't get paid when you don't work. Now, as an employee, you might not be working, but your boss is paying you anyway. Now, when you're sitting there in idle time and you're sitting there waiting, you know, for the boss, you know, you're getting paid. All right, let's go through this again. Profits are not wicked and evil. A profitable servant, described by God in the Bible, is one that goes above and beyond the call of duty. He says that a guy that just does what I expect or what I hired him to do is unprofitable. Now, that's the creator of the universe came up with that definition. Don't blame me now. So I took that to heart, and I have always produced more than was expected. When my boss tells me, this is what I expect from you, and I'm going to pay you $5 an hour, son, and I expect you to be here at 8 o'clock in the morning, and I expect you to put in eight hours of work, and I expect you to produce 100 sticks of wood here. That's the expectation. I look at that and I say, okay, I hear you. I will arrive 15 minutes late. I will leave 15 minutes after quitting time. And while I'm on the job and working, and if I'm expected to turn out 100, I'll turn out 110. And if I can come up with some formula that I can produce 120, I'll do it. If I can come up with some formula to produce 130, I'll do that. If I can double my production from 100 units to 200 units, I will do that. And I will expect my boss to pay me commensurate with my productivity and my ideas. And if I find a boss that won't do that, then I will leave that employment and I will go into competition with that boss. And while he's producing 100 units, I'll go over here and open up a business that will produce 200 units and I'll undercut him and undersell him and take his market share. That's what I'll do. Now, bosses, you know, I did this the other day. I had a job here, and there were three other companies in Gainesville that could do that job. So I looked at company number one, and I said, that's a pretty poor company. I looked at company number two, and I said, now, that's an acceptable company, but it's not a very good one. Then I looked at company number three, and I said, that's the company I'm going to hire because they're the best in the business. So I hired the best business in the company so that my competitors couldn't hire him. They would have to hire business number one or business number two, which aren't as good as business number three. That's what strategy is all about in business, and market share and profitability. Now let's suppose, and I'm going to tell you what the answer is. Let's suppose you go into business and you want to know what's the correct markup in my product line. The correct markup is 100%. If you buy it for a dollar, you expect to sell it for two. Now there's a cost of goods sold. And if it costs you 98 cents to buy the product, service it, and sell it, then you're only going to make 2 cents, 2%. But on the other hand, if you can get your cost down to 50 cents, then you're going to make 50 cents. So you'll make a 50% profit. And the better the job you do, the more efficient you are, the more you produce for less, the bigger your profit's going to become. And there's nothing wrong with making a good profit. Profit is not a dirty word. It comes from God Almighty Himself. That's what the free enterprise system is all about. In fact, if we all practiced the free enterprise system, and then we all had a little piece of ground and we were producing, you know, cabbages and lettuce and carrots and cows and goats and whatever it is we're producing, and we're producing to our utmost, we are doing the best job that we know how, we're going to be making profits. And the objective is to make the highest possible profit. If you could make a dollar, $2, $5, or $10 off of your labor, you're going to make the most that you can get. So if you can invest one and make one, that's wonderful. If you can invest one and make two, that's better. If you can invest one and make three, that's even more gooder. Invest one and make ten, that's spectacular. Nothing wrong with making a good profit. Don't be ashamed of your profit. Because as soon as you make a profit, you can rest assured that your competitors are going to lower their price and compete with you and take your market share when you charge too much. That's what keeps prices in line, competition. Hey, I'm out of time again. I got to give you a final reminder here that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law School, The Law Hour, rather, is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. And we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Now, The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. And the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. And all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and that's for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, there's the signal, says our times. If I got to leave it right there, we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course, so until then. Thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.